Good evening and welcome to lesson 4 of Advice for Life. Could you believe it? We're already at lesson 4. Trying to get this to work. Okay, now it works.
Beautiful.
So, healthy at heart. Great to see everybody. And we will open with a short prayer. I'm going to recite Psalm 121. We'll keep in mind all of the hostages, that they return home immediately, and all the members of the IDF, that they too return home, and not before they're successful in their mission. Shir la'malot esa'ina yalaharim mi'ayin yavo ezri ezri me'im adonai osei shemayim v'aretz al yitein la'moit raglecha al yanum shemrecha hine le'yanum v'le'yishon shemer yisrael adonai shemrecha adonai tzulcha yad minecha yoyma ma'shemesh le'yakaka v'yareach balayla adonai yishmorcha mikara yishmer es nefshecha adonai yishmor tzeischa uv'yecha me'ata v'yad oylam. The Lord will guard your going and your coming from now and for all time.
Amen.
Amen.
Is that the shortest psalm?
No.
No.
No, that's 121. It's not the shortest. There's about, from 120 to like 134 are very similar size. They're all short. But the shortest is 117. Two verses.
Oh my.
Yes, okay, so tonight's lesson, which is healthy at heart. If I could trouble somebody to hit the number one on the screen as soon as they ring the bell. Lou, thank you. Just hit the number one, thank you. So,
that's such impeccable timing.
It's all orchestrated from above, right? There you go. Thank you. So, I know we kind of say this certainly before every course and maybe even before every class. Good evening, Larry and Lynn. Great to see you. We're just starting. Welcome to Lesson 4. Healthy at Heart. So, it's a very exciting class tonight. You made a very wise decision to put other maybe even important things aside, and to be here. And I know it's never easy to make decisions of what to do with our time, but you will be delighted that you chose to be here tonight. So last week we already spoke about health. We spoke about health, let's just say, we'll call it, for the lack of a better term, we'll call it external, even though there could be internal diseases too. But just health in general. In very brief, we talked about the need for preventative measures when it comes to health. When facing a health challenge, we spoke about staying positive, being productive, strengthening one's trust in God, and to let God take over, and to put all our trust in His hands. We spoke about the Torah mandating us to follow instructions of doctors, but we shouldn't do so to an obsessive measure of jumping from one doctor to the next. We should trust a doctor. Doesn't mean we only have to go to one. We should go to one, we should get a second opinion, and if you're still not sure, get a third opinion, and then follow the majority at that point. And then realize that your choice of doctors and the fact that you're even going to a doctor is only because they are a messenger and a conduit for God's blessing. And that's why we do so. Today, we're going to take a step going more inside, a little more internal. And we're going to talk about emotional health and well-being. Reminder to turn your phones off if they aren't yet. So, the deal is that today, in 2024, in the United States, most certainly, we live in perhaps the most prosperous time ever. Yet at the same time, even though it's the most prosperous, and even though not everyone has the same as everybody else, but even those who are, let's just say, who are just okay in this country, are way better off than the vast majority of people in time in earlier times. So everyone's blessed with prosperity to one degree or another. Yet, if I ask you, did that bring happiness along with it? Is having more, does that spell more happiness? No. In fact, they say that one out of four people in the United States, one out of four people, I don't know if it's adults or people, probably adults, suffer from some type of mental health related issue. Which just goes to show that even though we have more than we ever did before, it doesn't mean that there was an uptick on the happiness scale. So if that's the case, and we're all still pursuing happiness, we know where it doesn't come from. The question is, how do we find it? And not that happiness per se is tonight's topic, but of course it's tied in, because we're talking about how to deal with mental health. But the key is to find peace and to find happiness. The question is, where does it come from? We know where it doesn't come from, but certainly the answer is that it doesn't come from anywhere outside of us. That we can rest assured. If it's going to happen, it's going to come from the inside. So the question is how. So we're going to explore, of course, as we have been in the last three lessons of this course. We're going to talk about Jewish wisdom from various different sources within Jewish literature, but specifically from the Rebbe's perspective. And we're going to discuss how to deal with and how to counter things like sadness, anger, anxiety, melancholy, depression. And I'm going to say, probably for the first of, for sure, more than once tonight, that everything we're going to be discussing tonight is, of course, the Rebbe's, largely the approach the Rebbe took. I'm going to establish now that the Rebbe did also send people to doctors and also to get medication when necessary. When necessary, most certainly, that should be done. And that we're all aware of, and it basically goes without saying that when someone has a clinical issue, they most certainly should see a mental health professional and follow their instructions. The question is, what about up until that point? And is it possible, are there remedies or ways to deal with it when we are still before that stage, let's just say? So tonight we're going to open a window to the Rebbe's perspective, which we saw basically was a recurring theme in responding to people that reached out to him for advice in this area. And as we already established, thousands or tens of thousands reached out to him over the decades of his leadership. And we know this because we hear the stories from the people, and we also read the letters. We have access to the replies that the Rebbe wrote to people. I don't know if I mentioned this previously, but I know I did mention the fact that there's a set of books which include just his responsa, just letters, not his Torah teachings or his public lectures, just his letters that cover close to somewhere between 35 and 40 volumes today. And over there, the way it works is, now if a letter was very private, then it wouldn't even make it into this book. Meaning, if it was very private and you would be able to figure out who it was, even with names removed, it wouldn't be in the book. There are many, the vast majority of letters in the book are printed, but the name is removed. You wouldn't know who it was written to. And if there were any, you know, details that would be determining, those too were removed. Now, we don't have the letters that the people wrote to the Rebbe, but from the response, you can often certainly get a clue of what the person's question was. So that's how we figure out what issue is being addressed, and certainly we have an idea, even if not 100% clarity on exactly what the issue was. So we're going to be, as we have already been tonight too, we're going to be looking at some of those letters, and tonight we are going to we're going to get to it shortly, but we're going to start with four case studies. When I say start, I mean in a minute, but first a little bit more of an introduction. If I asked you to describe what a typical classic therapy session looks like in your mind's eye, describe the scene. What does it look like? What does the room look like? What's happening?
Now, you're not referring to physical therapy, are you?
No, let's say mental health.
Patients talking, doctors listening.
Patients talking.
And maybe then reflect
back. Excellent. Are they both standing?
No, they're sitting.
Okay, so tell me what the room looks like. Don't be shy.
I would say an office or living room, kind of.
Okay, maybe a couch.
But not one of the chairs.
Okay, possibly a doctor behind the desk or sitting on a chair.
When it projects like warmth.
Okay, warmth.
Not behind a desk, sitting around. Maybe if it's psychiatry, they're possibly lying. The patient's possibly lying.
Okay, couch, lying down. But
there's no barrier between doctor and patient.
Okay, great. And one thing that was said before was that the patient is speaking. And that's key here. Because typically, what people are used to, the general approach to therapy that is most common, we'll call it the outside going inward approach. You start from the symptoms, and then the medical professional, the mental health professional, is going to help you kind of advance and try to get to the core of the issue, until they figure out exactly which parent's responsible, etc. But they're going to be going from the outside in, from the symptoms, and trying to get to the core of it and uncover the core of the issue. And that's generally the approach. And today we're going to be talking about a different approach, not from the outside in, and we'll see shortly what I mean. But first, we don't have this in the book itself, but I'm just going to share something with you, a Talmudic teaching, and that is that there's a verse, I believe it's in Proverbs somewhere, I can't tell you the chapter, actually I think I wrote it down, actually it's chapter 12, verse 25, and over there it says in Hebrew, four words, Daiga belev ish yishachena. Now, what it means, just off the bat, means when somebody has worry in their heart, when somebody is overcome with anxiety, then there's one word that tells you what to do. Daiga belev ish means when you are overcome with anxiety. Then yishachena. Question is what that word means. So on a very literal level, it means like to quash it. But we don't really know what that means. So in the Talmud, the sages actually discuss this word. What is the verse saying to do when you are overcome with anxiety or worry, etc.? So one says that the meaning of that word should be read a little differently. Now in Hebrew, if you change around some vowels, the whole word could change. If you're reading it differently, the whole meaning could change. So if you take the word yishachena and you turn it around a little bit and you turn the shin into a sin, then you read it yasichena. Anyone know what sicha means in Hebrew? Sicha means to talk. If you're overcome with anxiety, speak it out. Share it with somebody, the verse says. Daiga belev ish, what should you do? Yasichena. You should discuss it. You should talk to somebody about it. It may be a friend. It may be a health professional. But you should talk about it. And that's really key to what we are, by the way. The way we stand out over other creations from the beginning of, as soon as man was created, we're described as a communicative creature. The ability to communicate. Vayehi ha'adam le'nefesh chaya. The Targum, the translation in Aramaic, immediately says that it refers to our ability to speak. That is where we stand out. So here, why is it? What lies in speaking? When we speak something out, what happens? If you are sometimes, maybe you have something in your mind, but you want to understand it a little better. If you explain it, if you articulate it, you then comprehend the idea better than you did before. So speech actually increases our comprehension of given idea. When we speak it out, it helps us understand better. So that's number one. Not only that, sometimes you may feel like you need clarity on a certain issue. You'll pick up the phone, you'll call your friend or whoever's on your A-list for such purposes, and they'll pick up the phone and you'll say, "Could you hear me out for a minute?" And you'll speak it out. By the time you finish talking, you have your answer already. They didn't even open up. They didn't open their mouth yet. They may say something, they may not, but you already have clarity just by sharing it. That is the first thing that the sages say. Yasichena means to speak it out. And when you share it with somebody else, you also have the ability to actually get advice from somebody when you actually do so. So that's all the first meaning in the Talmud that they give us for the meaning of that word, which basically tells us what to do with anxiety. Speak it out. And if you will, we can basically summarize the common approach to dealing with these types of issues, which is the common therapy approach, to speak it out, usually a mental health professional, and in so doing, you get to the core of the issue. So that's all what commonly is done as far as this approach, and we could say that it relies on that opinion of our sages. Just going to take a look here at the screen for a second. A common theme is fixating on an issue in order to understand it. So that's basically what we're talking about. And part of that is speaking it out. But now the Talmud tells us another possibility. Instead of reading the word yasichena with a sin, which means to speak, switch the sin to a samach. Sounds the same, yasichena, but it's a different word, because now it's not a sin, it's a samach. What does yasichena means? It means you should banish the thought from your mind. Yasichena comes from a well-known term called hesach hadas, which means to distract yourself from a given topic or given issue. If something's on your mind, you want to remove it from your mind, it's called yasichena with a samach. The same word, small modification, and that already means to banish the negative or the anxious thoughts that you're overcome with. Not to dwell on it. To like eject it, to remove it from your mind, and to move forward, and to try to move away from it. This is the novel approach that we'll be talking about, very much the Rebbe's approach to these types of issues. Moving the mind away from bothersome thoughts and towards productive activities. Okay, obviously, like other times we said, when we spoke advice during this course, it's easier said than done. Get rid of the negative thought. Okay, but how do you do that? And as we all know, that when you try to... when you try to banish a thought, what happens? If you tell yourself, okay, I'm not thinking about pink elephants, what happens now? The only thing you think of is pink elephants. So what does it mean to say when we're overcome with negative thoughts or overcome with anxiety, and there's a broad spectrum of negative thoughts that we could be overcome with, and we're saying just banish the thought. Well, what exactly does that mean? So we're going to discover more shortly. First, I just want to share... I'm going to touch on something now. We're going to come back to it a little bit later, but I think it's worthwhile hearing twice. What this means is, when we say to banish a thought, and then what? Basically, Torah believes, Judaism believes, and therefore, of course, the Rebbe believes, that every single person has at the core a spark of God. You can call it your soul, your neshama, that place of innocence, of purity, of pristine health. Basically a deep reservoir and wellspring of everything that's good, that's pure, that's positive, that's healthy. Every single one of us have it deep down at the core. When we are overcome with something negative thoughts, worries, anxiety, etc., all of that is something external that is not coming from our core. It's maybe an experience that we had that brought it onto us. Or we were anxious about something potentially in the future. Who knows? All these things are not at our core. They're all things that come from the outside and attach themselves to us. If that's the case, then what we're going to discover in this advice is when we say to banish the negative thoughts, what we're saying is to remove that negative energy, we'll just call it. How do you do it? By tapping in to what we have at the core. It's not just about getting rid of that thought. Well, how is it really happening? Well, the way it's going to happen is by tapping into what we already possess at the core of who we are, at the core of our being. And in so doing, we'll be able to, so to speak, unleash a whole fresh wellspring of positive energy, of healing powers, etc., from within. But we'll come back to this thought soon. I just wanted to drop it so we can start thinking about it. But now we're going to examine four case studies from the Rebbe's engaging with people and counseling them when it came to mental health related matters. And as we'll see, every one of these four are different situations, different types of people, different circumstances, but we will discover an underlying theme in the Rebbe's approach to these matters. So let's go to the first case study, and that is, by the way, any comments? So far, so good? Okay. So for our first case study, it's a letter addressed to a young man who seemingly, again, we get the idea from the letter, but apparently this young man wrote to the Rebbe about bothersome thoughts that he had, that were plaguing him, as well as painful emotions of guilt and regret over maybe past unbecoming behavior. So basically two areas that it seems like he was addressing. Number one were just negative thoughts that were plaguing him, and also guilt and regret over things in the past. So let's jump in. We're on page 92, and we will go to text 1A. We'll start from my left today. Paul, you're a Cohen, right? You got to go first. So one.
I don't know why you're doing this.
Okay. Cohens go first. So 1A, please.
With regard to the thought which you expressed in your letter, I believe I have already written to you before, and there are many problems and states of mind which are best dealt with by dismissing them from the mind completely, at any rate for a period of time. It is then possible to return to those problems with a fresh mind and a more objective state, so as to evaluate the problems in their true perspective. In reality, it is then easier to find the proper solution. In the vast majority of such cases, the individual himself can decide how long this period of dismissal from attention should be, judging by the degree of objectivity which he can attain as time goes on.
Okay, thank you. So here we have this big idea that what's the Rebbe suggesting to this individual? That he should dismiss the thoughts from his mind completely. We're already seeing the Rebbe writing this idea to him and making this recommendation. Just banish the thought. Remove it from your mind. Now, as we said before, as soon as we identify something and we say don't think about it, that's all you could think about. So the question is how? How does this young man do this? This letter was written, by the way, in 1965. How does he take this idea and actually get over the guilt, the regret, the negative thoughts that he was overcome with? So we're going to continue. Same letter in 1B.
Ron.
Okay, whichever. Perfect. 1B, please.
Needless to say, also, that it is not an easy thing to dismiss a problem from the mind, especially a matter that involves one's own self. This would be almost impossible unless one can engage one's thoughts and attention in a completely unrelated subject. For man's thinking process is constantly in a state of flux and has a tendency, consciously or subconsciously, to revert to the subject matter which one wishes to dismiss from the mind. Therefore, when resolving to dismiss the matter from one's mind, it is necessary immediately to find some other subject unrelated to the first in which to engage one's attention. Another point, which is also almost universally true, is that it is not easy for the person involved to find the proper subject in which to engage one's mind. But here it is possible to receive help from friends who would know you and your psychological makeup. Undoubtedly, you have such friends within reach.
Thank you. So the Rebbe is writing to this young man that, yes, we acknowledge that this is a very difficult task to banish thoughts from your mind, because you can't just shut your mind off. It doesn't work that way. So what do you do? It's not about banishing this thought. That would be an exercise in futility, to just try to rid your mind of a thought. Now, that's the goal, but that's not the process. That's not how you do it. What you do is you need to have another unrelated topic or subject to move your thoughts over to. It's not about getting away from this thought. It's about going to a different thought. In other words, you have to have other things in your life that you can move your mind and your thoughts over to. You can move your focus over to other things. And then, by default, when you do that, you're going to be banishing the thought that you're going away from. The negative thoughts are not going to have a host, because your mind is now occupied with other things which are more positive and more uplifting, and they do better for you. Good evening. So that's a key factor here. The key is to have an unrelated area entirely outside of whatever is bothering the person, and that's where you need to engage your mind. You have something positive going on in your life. You have to have it ready, that whenever you're overcome with negative thoughts, move your mind over to something else. Start thinking, actively thinking about something else. Then the negative thoughts will be banished as a result. So, yes?
We do this with children. They're doing something that we wish them not to do, so we redirect them to something they do want to do. Maybe give them another toy or read them a book.
We thoughtful parents do that.
Thoughtful parents.
Yes, but many, and the thing that we do without thinking much is just taking the thing away. We're not necessarily putting in the thought to replace it with something else, and maybe we'll have a better success rate in doing that. But yes, thank you. Thanks for sharing that. So let's go to 1C, which is the third segment of the same letter. Larry, please.
Generally,
page 94.
The teaching of our sages that nothing stands in the way of repentance for the past and commitment for the future. Here too, the principle enunciated above may be applied. Namely, that although it is necessary to end the transgression immediately, whether it is a sin of commission or omission, it is also necessary to end immediately any self-recrimination or brooding in regard to the sins of the past. One of the obvious reasons for this is that brooding over past failures is found to be depressing and discouraging, and would undermine one's confidence in the future, even one's confidence in the efficacy of teshuva. Therefore, it is advisable to dismiss such thoughts for the time being and leave them for more propitious times. May God grant you should have good news to report in regard to all the above.
Thank you. So if the earlier section of the letter was focusing more on his negative thoughts, this last segment is focusing more on the regret and the guilt that he was overcome with from something he may have done in the past. And here the Rebbe is telling him that, look, if you're a Jew and you believe in God and you believe in the Torah, then the Torah, actually in this week's Torah portion, somehow always works out that way, we're introduced to the idea of teshuva. The sin of the golden calf is, we actually study study it today, Monday, in the second portion of the Parsha. So we learn all about repentance, and it's a real thing. It's not just something that we say to feel good and whatever, so that we show up on Yom Kippur, and it's a real thing. Judaism really believes in second chances. If somebody regretted something they may have done, unbecoming, and they really turned themselves around, then we need to be able. There's two things. We have to be able to forgive ourselves. If we did it and we personally repented, we need to take that seriously and look at ourselves differently. We need to view ourselves as a different person if we sincerely repented after whatever given act or event in our past. And we have to really accept ourselves as a new person. Also other people, by the way, but that's a different discussion. If somebody did something and we know that they sincerely repented, and we really know that they did, we have to be able to accept them, just like we would like to be accepted if it was us. Or if it happened to your brother, how would you accept him after repentance? We have to be willing to embrace people like that, even though it may feel a little bit uncomfortable. But if it's a real thing, then we have to absolutely follow through on it. So here's the issue with guilt. Very often, people like dwelling on the past, on past mistakes that they made. They actually, it almost feels cozy to kind of stay there. Sometimes people justify this behavior of kind of not moving away from their past sins. They actually convince themselves that they are more moral and ethical, and they're actually more of an upright person by kind of always beating themselves up about some past mistake or sin that they may have committed. That's what they think. So they think it's actually a positive to keep beating yourself up about it. But the truth is, that's absolutely wrong. The Torah's perspective is that tshuva, repentance, is real. And not only that, as one writer put it, that when you continuously beat yourself up over something, it's not just that it doesn't do good for you. It's actually the evil inclination trying to get you not to move forward. You know why? Because by staying in that space of the sin and constantly, so to speak, beating yourself up about it again and again, you're basically reliving the sin again and again. That's the evil inclination getting you to actually get to suck more juice out of the sin that you committed. By getting you to not move away from it, it's almost, now you're not actually doing it, but in your mind and in your persona, that voice is getting you to stay in the sin, and you're like committing it again and again by not moving on from it. That's why it's key to really take repentance seriously and to realize that I'm not the same person anymore. I'm not the person who committed that sin. And for that reason, and this is what the Rebbe is trying to get this young man to realize, don't be plagued by things that you've done in the past. You sincerely repented, you've advanced, you've made progress, you're not the same person. You should not be overcome with those thoughts, unless you don't believe in the Torah and you don't believe in Teshuvah. But that's not the case. You do. And if you do, then it's really necessary to take it to heart and to realize that you moved away from it and that's not you anymore. And in so doing, you'll be able to get over these feelings of regret and of guilt. So just to sum up this case study number one, he was overcome with bothersome thoughts and guilt. In order to shut off undesirable thoughts, engage the mind in unrelated areas. But what is that? So how do we do it when it comes to regrets? Judaism believes in tshuva, second chances. One's actual behavior must change for the better, obviously. But then, don't brood over the past. Invest energy in present life. That is where we see the theme already, that we're going to continuously see tonight, but we already see it. In our first case study, where the Rebbe is encouraging this young man, don't dwell on these thoughts. It's not going to do you any good. You have to move away from it by replacing it with something positive in your life. And, of course, after you change your behavior to realize that teshuva is real And with that, you moved on to a new phase and a better phase in life. Yes?
I know this isn't a comparative religion class, but this to me is really important difference between Judaism and Christianity, because Christianity believes in this concept of inborn sin, original sin, which we don't. And, you know, to me, their whole philosophy is based on the idea that you can never get over that, and Judaism has exactly the opposite approach. And I think it's really a huge thing, including the way that society looks at things that go on outside.
Yeah, yeah, thanks for sharing that. Absolutely. Now, there's, well, I'm not going to get into it now, but the effect, let's just say, of Adam and Eve eating from the tree, the effect of what they did is basically permanent. But it's not to say that if we do something, we absolutely could turn our lives around. So again, it's not a comparative religion class. Nor can I speak on it, obviously. But there's anyway, there's various different components to it. But generally speaking, you're absolutely right. Teshuva is a real thing. Okay. Are we good with case study number one? Let's go on to number two. Number two, we're going to turn to the video screen, as we have been a lot during this course. And here we're going to be introduced to a woman. I believe, yeah, her name is Mrs. Tyvel Lipsker. Anyone ever hear of any Lipskers? Yeah? Oh, yes, you know a Lipsker from Orlando. So this is his grandmother, actually.
From Crown Heights.
She lived in Crown Heights, yeah. I mean, a lot of them live there. Many of them are all over the place. As far as local, I mean, I know it's no big deal, but Rabbi Lazaroff Sr. is related to the Lipskers. Actually, his mother's maiden name was a Lipsker.
So Jenkinson's.
Well, ultimately, everybody somehow. But anyway, so this is Mrs. Tyvel Lipsker, like a matriarch of a large Chabad family. And here, a grandson of hers is going to be recounting a story about her. I think I'm going to let the video speak for itself.
My grandmother, Tyvel Lipsker, was a very, very special and holy woman. Like many of our grandmothers, she did not enjoy a serene and easy, smooth life. Growing up in Bolshevik communist Russia as a Jew was difficult. Raising a family in Georgia during the 1930s under Stalin's tyranny was far from simple. Then came the war. They escaped the former Soviet Union on false papers, came to the displaced persons camps, the DP camps. Again, life was anything but serene, raising a large family, sometimes in one bedroom flat. My grandparents made it in 1947 to the United States of America. They settled on a farm in New Jersey. That too didn't turn out so successful, and they relocated to Brooklyn, New York. My grandparents raised 9 beautiful, amazing children and a 10th orphan. Making a livelihood proved very complicated, and the upheavals of her life took their toll on her. She suffered from anxiety, from depression, from melancholy. And one day my grandmother consulted the Lubavitcher Rebbe what to do about her internal psychological and emotional state. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe gave her fascinating advice. He suggested to her that she go to as many Jewish weddings as possible and to dance away at these weddings and inspire other people to dance. As it happens to be, my grandmother was an exceptionally skilled dancer. She embraced the Rebbe's advice, and for decades, she would go to every possible wedding and dance away. Family, friends, relatives, community members, and sometimes complete strangers. Everybody knew Mrs. Lipsker is here. She is the life of the wedding and the life of the party. This was not part of her nature. This was quite contrary to her nature, but she did it, and she did it with every fiber of her being. She lived in Crown Heights in Brooklyn. There were many Bali tshuva, young women and men who returned to Judaism, and they had small families attending the wedding, or sometimes no families. And my grandmother would come in, and she brought so much joy and vigor and stamina and inspiration to the wedding. She would dance away sometimes for hours with the bride and with the mothers and with the siblings and with the families and with the relatives. And indeed, the joy that she brought to hundreds and thousands of people over long decades, it came back to her. It gave her so much joy and strength and fortitude and resilience and inspiration. Besides the fact, exercising a few times a week for a few hours a night, dancing with all your might, is also very effective for anxiety.
Here we see a fascinating example of where the Rebbe's approach, instead of focusing and dwelling on the problem and getting lost in it, which could just lead to a downward spiral, instead find something totally unrelated and invest your time and your energy there, and that will be the answer. And that's exactly what happened with Mrs. Tybel Lipsker. Questions? All good. Okay, let's go on to case study number 3. Our next one's also a video, but a very short video. So I'm going to give a little introduction to this video, and that is that a raise of hands, was anyone at what's known as the Shul of Bell Harbor, Florida?
I've heard of it.
So it's a Chabad center, but it's called the Shul of Bell Harbor. They got the name from us. Just kidding. The other way around. And it's huge. It's on Collins Avenue, 9500 or 9540 Collins Avenue. It was huge before their expansion. But a year ago, they just finished a $35 million expansion. I believe now they cover until 96th Street, like the rest of the block. And then come the Bell Harbor shops across Bay Harbor or whatever it's called, Kane Concourse or something. Anyway, point is that the founder and leader of this shul is, what do you know, Rabbi Shalom Lipsker. Different topic, though. Now, this Rabbi Lipsker also got another assignment from the Rebbe. In 1981, I believe, the Rebbe wanted somebody to take up the mission of reaching out to Jews who are imprisoned. And Rabbi Lipsker was at that address when the Rebbe spoke about wanting to outreach to begin to this segment of the community. And he wrote a note to the Rebbe the next day that he's willing to consider it. And he did. And immediately he took on this position. Until today, he is the founder and director of the Aleph Institute, which caters to Jewish people who are incarcerated all over the country. And they operate on many different frontiers. Obviously, most of their work we will never know about, I guess, thank God. But those who need it, whether for themselves or a family member, they do incredible things and are advocates, etc. So there was once an individual who came out of prison. And while he was in prison, this is about 1991, he benefited from the work of the Aleph Institute. So when he came out, he came to see the Rebbe, number one, to thank the Rebbe for the Aleph Institute because it helped him out. And additionally, the conversation continued, and the Rebbe encouraged him, very simple words, he encouraged him to forget about his past. Your past and your whole prison experience, forget about it. And he said, well, it's kind of difficult. And the Rebbe said that if you'll try, you'll be able to figure it out. Let's watch it, and then we'll talk about it a little more afterwards. You will not see the face of the individual. It's kind of covered on the video. And probably the voice has also changed up a little bit. But let's take a look. It happens pretty quick, so.
I was in prison, and this Rabbi here and also feeling
of you helped me get through. But you might soon forget about all this past.
I did.
It's not here the same. You know what Passover is?
Yes.
Yeah. In the Jews had forgotten about Mitzrayim. It is time for you to forget about your prison also. A lot of much blessing, even if it's a difficult, but try your best. God Almighty bless you.
Thank you.
Here too, obviously, here you would say, you know, very easier said than done, of course. And it could sound simplistic, but what we're discovering here, and we'll discover more soon, that there is an actual logic behind this. We'll come to it shortly. But what the Rebbe was saying to him is, if the Jewish people were able to leave Egypt, and they didn't just leave Egypt geographically, they left Egypt also psychologically. You know, as they say, you could take the Jew out of Egypt, but could you take Egypt out of the Jew? And that's really the key. You can be out of Egypt geographically, but you may still be stuck there. In fact, there's a mitzvah, which somewhere in Deuteronomy, which says that you should not hate an Egyptian because you were a stranger in their land, because they welcomed you to their land. Now, we're talking about Egyptians who... I don't need to tell you about the abuse that they perpetrated against the Jewish people and the women and the children and the babies and the men and the hard work, etc., for close to 100 years. But for 100 years before that, they also welcomed you when you needed somewhere to go during famine. Because of that, and don't confuse this with forgiving and forgetting and making believe they didn't do anything. That's not what the point here is. The point here is that you should not be overcome with hate towards the Egyptians, because they also did something good for you. Yes, justice needs to be meted out, and it was, but you know what? God took care of it. You left Egypt. Don't take the hatred for Egypt with you for the rest of your life, because then you're basically missing the point to a degree. You never really left it if you're just hating on them. Now, again, a second time, don't confuse this with, like, making believe there's no evil in the world and just forgiving people who killed your parents or grandparents in the Holocaust. It's not the point, and don't confuse the two. It's not for us to mete out the justice. Maybe God needs to sometimes. But at the same time, it's also not for us to forgive. We can't forgive on behalf of our parents or grandparents. They could. We can't. It's not our business. But, I'm digressing, let's stick to the point here. And the point is, not to be overcome with hatred, the Torah tells us, for the Egyptian. The key is to be able to leave Egypt. And we have to leave our personal Egypt. In the case of that individual, it was now that he turned his life around and he repented, he did the crime, he did the time, now put it behind you and engage on positive things, find positive things to fill your schedule, your mind, and you'll be able to have a bright future. Yes.
Do you know where in Torah that is? Because the first generation didn't mentally leave Egypt, and that's why they didn't enter the Promised Land. But when Moses spoke to the second generation in Deuteronomy, they were able to mentally leave Egypt.
Certainly, yeah, certainly more than the generation prior. I mean, there's a number of components too, and the sin of the spies, etc., you know, everything bunched together. But, I mean, I could find it easily after the class.
Rabbi, it's interesting that the Rebbe talked about his prison time in the same, I'm going to say, vernacular, as the Rebbe talks about Jews leaving Egypt. It's like his prison was his Egypt.
Yeah, now it doesn't mean what got him into prison was as innocent as what got the Jews into Egypt. Right. I'm just stating the obvious. But for him, you're right. For him personally, that was a time. It was a negative past, and now he has to emerge from it and find a positive, bright path forward. Good? Okay, let's go over to number 4. This is the most exciting, just kidding, but this addresses sibling issues, but not as dramatic as you think. So the recipient of this letter, the fourth of our four case studies, is a mother of two daughters who reached out to the Rebbe for advice. Now her two daughters, the younger one, was going through a rough time emotionally, showing like apathy and disinterest in a lot of areas of life, and wasn't functioning the way she should, and wasn't active the way she should be. So she wrote this letter describing her daughter's situation and what's going on with the two of them and the younger one specifically, and also wrote that she was seeing a therapist and who was advising the mother on how to handle it, but clearly she was concerned and thought that maybe there's something wrong with her younger daughter. So let's take a look at the Rebbe's response in text 2A. Lynn, please.
The jealous sister. The reasons for your daughter, for your younger daughter's condition are not at all complicated. The causes seem to lie in the fact that your daughter is subconsciously jealous of her older sister. And such a feeling manifests itself by a desire not to be interested in those activities where the person is unable to compete successfully. Therefore, your younger daughter shows little inclination to engage in the activities in which her sister is more successful than she. However, since such is the attitude of jealousy, creating a subconscious feeling of guilt, one is prone to compensate for it by an outward show of attachment. That is why she flies to the defense of her sister if anyone should say anything disparaging against her.
Thank you. So for starters, as the Rebbe himself wrote, doesn't seem complicated. There's some jealousy issues here, and that's what's causing number one, her lack of interest in areas where she won't be able to compete successfully, so she doesn't bother. And also, she also stands up in defense of her sister because of the guilt, the feelings of guilt that produces. Now that that was put into perspective, the letter continues with advice for healing. Russell, are you good with 2B, please?
Restoring confidence. At the same time, this daughter suggests also the method of therapy, namely that every effort should be made to restore her confidence by offering her opportunities to engage in such activities where she can take a leading part and excel herself. Needless to say, this should be done in a gradual way, for in her present state of mind, she would be reluctant to undertake responsibilities all at once. But surely, both at school and other cultural circles, there are opportunities for her to develop her artistic and other talents. It would be psychologically beneficial to her if the activities would be of a kind in which her sister does not participate. The choice of such activities is fairly wide, and they could be cultural, charitable, or youth work among Jewish youth and the like.
Thank you. So again, following the same theme, after identifying the underlying issue of why the unhealthy relationship there, the Rebbe is saying to move away from the elephant, move away from it, and identify other areas entirely unrelated to her sister, and by expressing herself there, she'll be able to grow and build up her self-esteem, and that will be her best path forward. Okay, so that closes off the fourth of the four case studies. The Rebbe advised finding areas in which she could excel on her own. Okay, so with that, we spoke about the advice that the Rebbe basically, in one way or another, different circumstances, but it's a recurring theme of move away from it, move past it. But even though it may sound simplistic on the surface, what is the logic behind it? A, what's like the Torah idea behind it? Obviously, it is backed by Torah, if that's what the Rebbe promotes constantly. But what is it? What's the process? What's the logic behind it? So, I kind of touched upon it before, but the key is this, and just to contrast it again with the common approach. The common approach is that you try to, in Yiddish is a term, Paul, you ever heard of this term in Yiddish? Tegribel sich. to gribblin, to gribblezich means to obsess over something. So one approach is to just dig deeper and deeper into the problem. But what are you gaining by doing that? You're just staying within the issue. And the more you uncover, the worse it can get. And not to say that this isn't an approach, but there's a risk as well. And the risk is that if you're going to gribble in schmutz, everyone knows what that is, right? Then you're not going to find light there. Think of if you're, who knows, somewhere in the mud, you suddenly find a diamond and it's covered, and you want to uncover it. You want to remove the schmutz from the diamond. What are you going to do? You're not going to obsess over the dirt. You're not going to go analyze the dirt and put it under a microscope. You're just going to push it aside, and you're going to try to identify the diamond and get to it and polish it and let it shine. So why here would we suddenly, you know, these are our first world problems. People are so caught up nowadays with what they feel like and how something makes them feel, and how do I feel about how I feel, and how do I feel about how I feel how I feel, and there's no end to it. What the Rebbe is suggesting is, instead of obsessing there and just staying there and not being able to budge from that space, find something totally unrelated, a positive outlet where you can engage. Now, why does this work? So he explains, and let's read text number 3, and in there we'll be able to identify it. Jake, are you cool with that, please?
It is difficult to offer counsel from afar, as the conditions of the country, the family, and so on have a direct bearing on the situation. Those who observe a situation from close proximity are better and more expertly equipped to arrive at an effective treatment. However, since you have already written to me and everything is by divine providence, I wish to emphasize something that I have witnessed in the majority of similar cases. A decisive and extremely effective method, which to my amazement is not used, at least not as much as it should be used, is Hesach HaDa'at, guiding the patient to entirely remove their mind from actively dwelling on the problematic issues at hand. The more the patient succeeds in ceasing to think about and dwell upon these issues that are the cause of their problems, the greater will be the ability of their natural internal healing powers, along with their other positive and curative aspects, to function with increased intensity and bring about healing. The above may be accomplished through arranging that these individuals are preoccupied with activities that lead to personal fulfillment, such as doing someone else a favor, something that in any case is acceptable to all, and therefore should not be difficult to convince them to do. That is, this is particularly so nowadays when instability is so prevalent and individual needs are so numerous. It is relatively simple to find a way for these individuals to help others with activities that are consonant with the needs and nature of the locale and of the individual who requires healing.
Perfect, thank you. So I'm just going to hone in on the middle paragraph where we said, I think those are the key words here in this letter, about halfway through it. The greater will be the ability of their natural internal healing powers to be able to emerge. That is really the key here. Why are we saying to move your mind away from these things? Because as long as we're obsessing on the negative, then we're not allowing basically our natural healing powers that exist deep inside of us are all relegated to the back burner. We're not allowing them to be unleashed as long as we stay on the negative event, thoughts, or energy. But when we can move away from it, that allows space for the reservoir and the wellspring deep inside of us that we all possess. We have that spark, that divine spark inside of us, and we need to allow that healing power to emerge. That could only happen if we move away from the negativity. That is really the key. And of course, Torah believes in this idea. That's what we have, as we've discussed in many other occasions, how we're all defined by two souls. We have the godly soul, we have an animal soul. but the godly soul is at the core. And if we have it, that means we have the ability to be able to tap into it and identify with it, certainly when necessary. And when we can do this, then this will be the key to be able to unleash and unleash the positivity and identify with something more more powerful that we already have. So let's just catch up here. So we talk about life's healing power. What is the Torah basis for the Rebbe's approach? What is the logical basis? Faith in life's healing power. Divine inner health lies at the core of every human being, and engaging the mind in a healthy place brings that to the forefront. And that is the idea behind it. And when we do that, we will certainly see good results.
Rabbi,
yes?
I just want to make a comment. I don't want to go on a tangent, but I found it interesting that he said here at the bottom of the third paragraph that when instability is so prevalent and individual needs are so numerous, you know, particularly nowadays, I guess, as it relates to anxiety and things coming up.
Right. So,
I think that's an interesting comment he's making about.
So, because first of all, the experience that these individuals or an individual may be having is very individualized. So, when you're trying to find a path out for them, and you're trying to find positive things for them to engage in, then it should also be on an individual basis. Just because it's something positive doesn't mean it speaks to everybody. We need to be able to identify something that resonates with that individual, and that can serve as a springboard for them to introduce something unrelated, but something more positive into their life. But thank you for bringing our attention to those words. All right, let's close off this segment with a video of a renowned Romanian-born Israeli clinical, developmental, and cognitive psychologist. Yes. Let's turn our attention to the screen, and this will, towards the end, he actually highlights this idea of the faith in the power of the human being, and not to underestimate the power that each of us have, and it's just a question of being able to identify it.
Professor Reuven Feuerstein is a world-renowned Israeli clinical and developmental cognitive psychologist, founder and director of the International Center for the Enhancement of Learning Potential. His applied systems are being implemented in over 80 countries across the globe.
The rabbi referred to me children for their problems of development, some epileptic children, some Down syndrome children, and wherever I came, and wherever I visited or I worked in my field, people were addressing themselves to me, the rabbi wants you to see our child. And some of them have received really letters from the rabbi, or the word from the rabbi, that I should see their child. And one of the things I must say, they believe that such a thing is possible, that people with genetic disorders, chromosomal disorders, can be turned into high functioning, normal functioning, and close. Very close to study, to Yiddishkeit, etc. I heard it very much from the rabbi. So it was a daring thing, because at this time people didn't believe it's possible. One particular case which I cannot disclose, and therefore it came from country in Europe, this boy was considered to be mentally defective. One didn't believe that he will ever be able to function and to be independent and to be. And this man, the father, in some way was not a very religious person, came to the rabbi. The rabbi told them to bring his son to me. The son came here and was placed in a family. He learned to read. He was sitting here near this door on a chair with a tilim. The rabbi said to finish tilim each week. And he learned this, you know, the third year that he was with us. He learned this. And Baruch Hashem, this went very well. And we were already feeling that we have done what the rabbi told us to do and empowered us to do. And we have fulfilled the Torah. Then things happened. And this young man became in the greatest danger. Not only drugs, but things which I cannot tell you. He ran away and he came into a place from where very few people came out. And I then addressed myself to the rabbi. The rabbi said, Don't leave him off your hand. Continue. And he gave me even a suggestion to send somebody to take him out of this place. I have never believed it very possible. But the rabbi said, I've sent somebody. He took out this young man from this terrible, terrible, promiscuous drug people, with all there's no Averash Baolam, he was not involved with, came back. I want you to know, he is now the father of four children. Many of them, two of them, learning in yeshiva. And they are the only children of this family, only grandchildren of this family, which the parents, the grandparents can be proud of. I, as a psychologist, and one says a good psychologist, could never believe that this with my own knowledge and my own psychology, I would have ever been able to do it. Usually, in such cases, we raise our hands, nothing to do. Not with the rabbi. I must tell you something. Psychology, as it is taught, is very limited. Our understanding of the other is very much affected and related to our understanding of ourselves. In the way the rabbi understood the condition of the individual, the way he claimed and suggested and felt empowered to say, yes, do it. There was a very different way of seeing the human being. Not as a just reflection of yourself, but something which comes Ara Dilela.
Wonderful. Wonderful, very powerful. Okay, so with the time remaining, we're going to spend a few minutes, the closing section of tonight's class, exploring the very fascinating relationship of the Rebbe with one of the great fathers of modern psychology, Dr. Viktor Frankl. Of course, you may be familiar, author of the best-selling book, Man's Search for Meaning, founder of Logotherapy. Viktor Frankl lived in Vienna He spent 3 years in Nazi concentration camps. His parents, brother, and pregnant wife were all lost in Auschwitz, were all murdered. And despite all of this, he never wavered in his belief in human dignity. If you ever read his book, you know what the thrust of his big ideas are. And he always believed that regardless of what a person lived through or lives through, you always have the ability to transcend your circumstances. And nobody could really own you to the core. And another way that he puts it is, as long as a person has a why to live, then they can get through any what. As long as they have a why, as long as they have a purpose in life, then they can get through anything. So let's explore it a little bit, and we'll conclude shortly with a fascinating story. As far as, we'll do text 5. I'll encourage you to read it on your own. I kind of already mentioned some of it, and you'll read the rest of it afterwards. But the key is, in his belief, as we said, is the importance and necessity of finding meaning in life. And like I said, the meaning will enable someone to overcome painful experiences. Now, the Chabad rabbi in Vienna, his name is Rabbi Jacob Biederman, and they are in Vienna since 1981. When they got there, they were aware that this famous psychotherapist lived in Vienna, but he never associated with the Jewish community, and they never had the opportunity to connect with him. However, one year, they sent out their annual appeal, and a donation came back from Dr. Frankel. And that actually continued after that. Every year, before the high holidays, when they sent out their annual calendar or whatever, he would always send back a donation. Now, they still were never able to meet, but one day, Rabbi Biederman got a visitor, and that kind of gave him a bit of insight, which changed everything. So with that, we will turn to the screen to get the story of Dr. Viktor Frankl.
Rabbi Yaakov Biederman is the director of Chabad Lubavitch in Austria. Shortly after he arrived in Vienna in 1981, he began to receive annual contributions from Dr. Viktor Frankl, the pioneering psychiatrist and founder of logotherapy.
התעלומה הזו, שפרופסור פרנקל מצא לנכון לתרום דווקא לחב"ד, לארגון דתי, לארגון שעוסק בהפצת היהדות, למרות שהוא עצמו לא, בשום צורה לא הזדהה כאדם ששייך, נפטרה לנו הרבה שנים אחר כך. רק בשנת תשנ"ה. איש ביטחון מודיע לי שישנה אישה שמבוגרת, שמעוניינת לפגוש אותי, ואני אמרתי לו שיכניס אותה. והיא התחילה במילים האלו, היא אמרה לי, קוראים לי מרגרטה חיוס. אם אתה חושב שאתם השלוחים הראשונים של רבי לאוסטריה, יש לי בשבילך הפתעה. אני הייתי השליחה הראשונה של הרבי לאוסטריה. הייתי די עמום, והיא ממשיכה לספר. היא קיבלה הזמנה לפגישה ויחידות עם הרבי. ובאותה הזדמנות אני סיפרתי לרבי שמפעם לפעם אני חוזרת לאוסטריה. ובסיום אותו מפגש, אותה יחידות, הרבי ביקש ממנה שבפעם הבאה שהיא נוסעת לאוסטריה, הוא היה רוצה שהיא תיצור קשר עם המזכירות של הרבי. הוא רוצה לבקש ממנה שתמלא משימה מסוימת. זאת אומרת, רק כמה חודשים אחר כך התכוננתי לחזור לאוסטריה. אמרו לי בשמו של הרבי שכשאני מגיעה לווינה, שאני אצור קשר עם פרופסור ויקטור פרנקל, ושאמסור לו בשם הרבי, שלא יתייאש ושלא יבוש מפני המלאגים, ושימשיך בדרכו וימשיך בהפצת משנתו, שיתחזק והרבי מברך אותו שהשם יצליחו והוא יזכה לפריצת דרך. דוקטור ויקטור פרנקל היה פסיכיאטר עמית של זיגמונד פרויד לפני השואה בווינה. אחרי שהוא היה במחנות ריכוז וחווה מצבים יוצאי דופן, הגיע למסקנה הפוכה. הוא אמר, האדם ביסודו הוא מחפש תכלית ותוכן לחייו, ולכן הוא האמין שרפואת הנפש מאוד קשורה יותר עם הענקת תוכן ואמונה, ערכים לבן אדם. הוא עמד בראש מרפאה חשובה, והוא גם היה מרצה באוניברסיטה, והשתתפו רבים בהרצאותיו, אבל יחד עם זאת, הוא היה מושא ללעג ולקלס, כי הסקולה הפסיכואנליטית של פרויד שלטה בכיפה, והיו מפריעים לו אפילו באמצע הרצאות. הוא היה עד כדי כך פגוע שהוא באותם ימים, כשמרגרטה חייס חיפשה אותו במרפאה, אמרו לה שהוא כבר תקופה לא הופיע. היא הגיעה אליו הביתה. נקשה בדלת ללא כל הודעה, כי לא היה לה אפשרות להודיע לפני כן. והיא תיארה שכשהיא נכנסת לבית, כשהיא פותחת את הדלת, פותחת לה אישה שלא נראית יהודיה. היא יכלה אפילו להבחין שהיה תלוי אצליו בתוך הבית. היא הייתה בטוחה שזה מאוד מוזר שהרבי שולח אותה לעודד מישהו שגר בבית כזה. אבל בכל אופן היא עזרה אומץ ושאלה אם אפשר לראות בבקשה את דוקטור פרנקל, ואז הוא הופיע בפתח הבית. והוא שאל אותה מה הגברת רוצה, והיא ענתה לו שיש לה בשבילו מסר מרבי שניאורסון מברוקלין, ניו יורק. ואז היא אומרת לו, הרב שניאורסון ביקש ממני למסור לך שלא תתייאש, שתתחזק, אל תבוש בפני אלו שמליגים, סופך להצליח ותזכה לפריצת דרך. בערך, אילו, זה היה תוכן הדברים שהיא מסרה לו. היא אומרת, ההתרגשות שלו הייתה משהו שהיא מעולם לא חוותה אצל אדם מבוגר ועוד אצל אישיות כזו. הוא פשוט פרץ בבכי תמרורים. ואחר כך לקח לו זמן עד שהוא יכל לדבר, והוא הראה לניירות שהיו לו על השולחן. אילו היו ניירות דפסי הגירה לאוסטרליה. הוא היה כל כך מדוכא מהיחס אליו, שהוא החליט לעזוב את וינה. ועכשיו, כשהוא קיבל את המסר הזה ממנה, המסר שהרבי העביר אליו, הוא אמר לה, אני אתחזק. הוא אמר, אני חוזר. אני חוזר לעבודה ואני אמשיך. הוא התחיל בצורה מאוד בטוחה להטיף את משנתו. הספר שלו, האדם מחפש משמעות, Man's Search for Meaning, תורגם ליותר מ-12 שפות. הספר הופץ בלמעלה מ10 מיליון עותקים. אני רציתי לאשש את הסיפור הזה. אחרי שהיא סיפרה לי את זה, אני ביקשתי להתקבל לפגישה אצל פרופסור פרנקל. הוא כבר אז היה די מבוגר, למעלה מגיל 90. אני התקשרתי אליו ושאלתי אם הוא אוכל להתקבל אליו לפגישה. הוא אישית ענה בטלפון בבית. הוא אמר לי שהוא חלש מדי, הוא לא יכול להיפגש. הוא גם היה קצת קצר רוח, הוא לא היה במיטיבו. אז בכל זאת, בטלפון שאלתי אותו, אני עם השם הרבי מלובביץ', הרב שניאורסון אומר לו משהו, רציתי פשוט לבדוק את הנתונים, גם איתו אישית. ברגע שהוא שמע את שמו של הרבי, אז נימת הכל השתנתה לגמרי. הוא פתאום נהיה מאוד סבלני. הוא אמר, ודאי, ודאי ששמו של הרבי מלובביץ' אומר לי הרבה. אני חייב לו המון. אישו די עם זר פיל, הוא אמר לי בגרמנית. הוא הוסיף ואמר, איך פאר, איך שצד רבי זר. אחד מכן אין זר קריטי של מומנט כחולף. ברגע מאוד קריטי הוא עזר לי. אני חייב לו רבות.
Fascinating story. And somehow it was Dr. Frankel who needed the reminder that his work was actually meaningful. But what the Rebbe, even though they never met in person, the Rebbe and Dr. Frankel, but he saw in Dr. Frankel's approach something very much that resembled his idea and his approach. It may not be identical, but it was certainly a lot closer than other approaches were. And the fact that a person ultimately needed the key here is that unlike the common approaches, which is to dwell on the issue, Frankel saw it as finding something outside of you. You have to find meaning, in his words. If you find a purpose, if you find meaning, and invest your life in something that will bring meaning to your life, then that will be the key for you to be able to heal. Very similar to the Rebbe's approach. And this is why it resonated, and the Rebbe really wanted him to succeed. How the Rebbe got the information, that we don't know. That is left to remain a mystery, like many other questions about how the Rebbe got information. But we do know that Dr. Frankel needed to get that message exactly at that time, and it had its desired effect. We're just going to close with text 8C. Jane, would you like to read it for us, please?
Sure.
Thank you.
8C,
yes. Page 110.
Sure. Oh, consider well, there is so much to accomplish in our world, and each human carries so much potential. Due to the vast amount of work that needs to be done, we cannot afford to give up on even one capability or talent. It is therefore the mission of every single person to harness all the potentials and talents that they possess to improve their part of the world. The beginning, like with everything else, starts with learning the profession, acquiring the necessary knowledge in general, and especially the knowledge necessary for using the individual's unique talents. I hope that after you contemplate the above a couple of times, you will immediately begin being active, and you will not be fazed by the effort that is required. You will then be able to soon witness the fruits of your labor.
Thank you very much. So in closing, we have this uplifting correspondence. The Rebbe writes that it's a faulty assessment, what I believe she was writing. One's negative self-view is a false passing state. And realize that you could make a worthwhile contribution. Each person's unique capabilities make them an important contributor to society. And if you put in the work, even though the fruit that it may be slow, but it's steady. The road to leading a productive life is a gradual process, and the practical advice is, the Rebbe gives practical advice that enables the letter writer to continue growing. So with that, we close lesson 4. Thank you very much for joining, and we will see you, God willing, next Monday for lesson 5, which is overcoming challenges above adversity. Thank you. Have a great evening.
Thank you.